members and here, and some of our old members gone and new members gone. We do have Representative Davies, who's new to the committee, one of the members. Representative Elton is joining us today. He's not on the committee, but you're welcome to join us and participate. But welcome to the committee, Representative Davies.
Thank you.
Representative Coring will be here. He had surgery and is still recovering. He'll be back, I believe, Sunday, so he'll be here next week. Representative Martin, in his same seat that he's been in, we won't say how many years. Representative Mulder, myself. Representative Terrio is going to co-chair the committee this year. Representative Foster, Representative Kelly, and new to the committee this year is Representative Davis. Representative Moses is gone as well this year. Representative Grusdorf, I forgot to mention, is also on the committee again, but is not here today as well. So we do have a quorum. I'd like to welcome everybody back, and maybe just a couple of introductions so people in the audience and also people on the committee know some folks. Luann, if you'd like to introduce your staff and maybe just a brief explanation about what you do and how you work with the committee.
My name is Luann Christian, and I'm the committee supervisor for the support group. And I'm one of the secretaries, along with Charlene Smith, who's back in the green dress with the pearls. And she and I both take care of making sure the minutes are in proper order and that the bills are accepted and reported out in any form that they should be. And we record the minutes. If you have any questions about where your bill files are or anything that you should need in the committee, we're here to help you. And Pauline Swanson, sitting next to Char, is the committee clerk, and she helps us to put together the bill packets and make sure that the bills are filed in their proper places. If you have any questions, just feel free to contact us. We'd be happy to go over anything that you need in greater detail.
Thanks, Luann. And Mike, did you want to just briefly, Mike Green is our head of our fiscal division, legislative finance, and we don't have all of our analysts here, but we will eventually and introduce them all. But Mike, just real briefly.
Mr. Chairman, the analysts that we do have over here right now, real quickly, Dave Kontrovich, old man of the chairman. Got a new analyst from last year, Ginger Patton. Not sure who else is here. I know Virginia. Gretchen Maddox, excuse me. And Susan Taylor. I think they'll be seeing a lot of Susan, I hope, because she's doing a lot of work in the welfare reform area. So that's going to be a big entree on your plate. Our other analyst, Virginia Snodgrass, she's back over at the office. This is a newest analyst.
Okay, thank you. For everybody's information, we have split the duties of the committee a little bit differently this year. Last year, I had the operating budget and the bills, and Representative Foster had the capital budget. This year, we're kind of splitting it different. I will have the budgets. That means reappropriation, supplemental, operating, and capital. And Representative Terrio, who's the co-chair, will have the bill scheduling and dealing with all the bills, which means if you have a problem, you want a bill scheduled, you'd like some changes made, you get to talk to him this year. I don't have to, he'll find out in a hurry. There's an awful lot of work involved in, and a lot of politics, actually, in the process of dealing with bills. So we've kind of split it up a little bit differently. So, you know, if you have a budget question, budget subcommittees, anything to do with a budget, come and talk to me. If you have a bill scheduling or question on bills or committee substitutes or something like that, talk to Representative Terrio. And I don't know if you want to make any comments.
Well, later on, maybe at the end of the meeting, I've got just a few things to hand out, and I'll introduce some of my staff. Mike Tibbles, who actually has been worked in the building for a couple of years, will be the committee aide dealing with scheduling of bills, drafting of CSs. We want to keep a pretty tight control over those who are authorized to request CSs for the Finance Committee. We've authorized some of Representative Hanley's staff and a few people in my office so we can keep pretty tight control on what information is presented to the committee. Mike Tibbles will be the frontline person dealing with amendments, potential amendments to members or the administration bills. Sarah Fisher continues to work with me. She'll be handling the two or three agency budgets that I control, and will also be working on some of the larger legislative issues to come before the committee. And when they're in the committee room later on, perhaps I'll point them out.
And Representative James, you're welcome to join us. Representative Moses is not here today, nor is Representative Coring. You're welcome to sit at the table. So just join us if you would. My staff has learned that if they're here, they may get asked or introduced. So they've learned they're not here and probably watching on TV now that we have gavel, so I can't introduce them. But I do have Kip Knutson and Tom Maher that are doing a lot of the finance stuff, and Kim Duke will also be doing some of the work as well. We will have a little more organizational meeting too a little bit later, talk about some of the rules for once we get to the budget as far as what makes a quorum, how many votes to pass an amendment, and that kind of stuff. But I thought today we're ready for overviews. We're going to have overviews today and then start. We won't meet on Monday, but Tuesday through Friday of next week, we've worked with the administration and the court system and the university. There's a schedule out of the departments. We're trying to do roughly four per day. And then the following Monday, that's the 27th, is it, I believe. We also have a couple more overviews and any continuations that we might need to fill in. So we're going to try and spend all next week, basically, and the first day of the following week, just going through departmental overviews, asking questions, and getting that information disseminated. So we won't have any official positions. I will say the one thing that we'll continue the tradition that we've had, I guess, for a long time here, that new committee members can ask two questions per meeting for the first month. And that's not a... so anyway, we'll pretty much be going through overviews for the next week and a half, and try and get through the overviews. But the subcommittees, we'll be appointing those. I've sent out a memo to the majority members asking for them to put down their preferences for which subcommittees they'd like to serve on. I'm working with people right now to appoint subcommittee chairs. I've talked to both Representative Davies now and also the minority leader, Gene Cabina, on the minority members, asked them to organize who they think they would like to be on the subcommittee. So we'll let them work out who they want on the different committees. So we're in the process of appointing both subcommittee chairs and subcommittee members, and I'm hoping that by probably the end of next week we'll have that information out. It may be a little bit later. Sometimes it takes a while with scheduling problems and just conflicts of trying to get people on different committees, but the goal is to have the subcommittees announce both chairs and members by probably maybe not the following next Friday, but the following Monday or Tuesday. So that's kind of the time frame on that. Today we do have a general overview, a little discussion about governor's budget, fiscal gap, and we've asked Annalee McConnell, the director of OMB, to join us. And if you'd like to come up, and I know you're going to introduce a couple other folks as well, if you could just for the record give your name and affiliation, and then go ahead with a presentation. If somebody has an urgent question, feel free to wave at her and we'll ask it, but generally try and let her get a presentation done, and if you got a question, write it down, and then we'll go through questions and answers after they have a presentation. So welcome back.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Annalee McConnell. I'm director of the Governor's Office of Management and Budget, and I think probably in this first little part I'm going to do, you won't have too many questions unless you want to ask me how to spell our analysts' names. I mostly just want to introduce our folks and lay a couple of sentences worth of groundwork for the presentation that Commissioner Condon and his staff will be doing. I wanted to let you know that our chief budget analyst this year is Dan Spencer. I'll ask each person to stand as they call names. And he will be doing all of the coordination on the operating budget side. Our other analysts are some of whom are already standing, Dan Austin, Joan Brown, Jeff Hoover, who is also coordinating the capital budget, Don Mock, who isn't here today, Jonathan Sperber, and Royce Weather.
Sounds like you stole most of our old legislative people. I think all but one maybe have worked for the legislature before, but...
Well, actually, I think now I have a very nice blend of both folks with legislative experience, which I consider an asset because they bring the perspective that legislators have to this, and also people who've worked in departments, which helps us in terms of bringing some perspective about how all the things we do to the departments affects them in terms of deadlines and paperwork and so forth. So
we've done the same thing. We've got a few people that used to work in your
departments. Back and forth,
too,
so. Yeah. As part of the overview for the fiscal gap, I asked Commissioner Condon to come and talk about the revenue picture. And that's partly because as we look at the fiscal gap and how it changes from year to year, clearly the biggest variable that we have from one year to the next is on the revenue side rather than on the expenditure side. It really dwarfs the expenditure changes no matter how large the cuts. And while I think there's been a real positive informal agreement between the legislature and the administration that it doesn't make sense to try to budget week by week depending on what oil prices are that week. We've really settled, and I think very appropriately so, on having the fall forecast, which is what we use in our presentation of the budget to you, and then waiting until the spring forecast to really do the major adjustments so that by the time you're passing a budget bill, we're using more up-to-date information. However, this year there has been obviously a considerable amount of change from where we thought the world was last spring, and I thought it would be helpful for you to have a chance to hear from the folks at Revenue a little bit about the changes and where we think that may suggest that we're headed as opposed to just relying on the information of the fall forecast, which was out at the beginning of November. So with that, I wanted to let Commissioner Condon and his folks start that, and then I'll come back so that they don't have to stay if they don't want to go through the other parts on the overview. So any questions on that part so far?
Thanks.
Okay. Commissioner, if you could, just for the record.
Yes, I will. My name is Wilson Condon, for the record, Commissioner of Revenue, and with me is Dr. Charles Logsdon, who's the Chief Petroleum Economist. We'll be very brief here, talking first about short-term, where the story is price, and Dr. Logsdon will cover price and the current high prices and what that means, and then for the longer term, I'll talk about production volumes, which is the other variable that determines the state's oil revenue.
And I might just point out briefly for everybody, we do have a handout. I think this is what you're working off,
yes,
is
right, we are.
On most people's desks. Do we have extras for the audience? So there's some in the back there as well for people that are in the audience.
I'll just say a couple of more words, Mr. Chairman. The first couple of pages here, actually the first three, we put in for informational purposes. They simply reflect 1996 actuals, 1997, 98, and 99 fiscal year projections from the fall revenue forecast. They're broken down by revenue types, and it's whole slew of numbers. It may be that you'd have some questions about it, but given that this is an overview, I think that's probably not going to be the case. And unless there are questions that just jump off the page out of that blizzard of numbers, we'll move to oil prices.
Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Charles Logsdon. I'm with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, just referring to your handout, there is another, I should state that you should all have copies of the fall forecast. It's a document that we try to make sure that everyone has. The other thing that we do between forecasts is we produce a two-page, actually it's printed on one page, but it's called Revenues, and it updates the current oil price and production situation and gives you a reading on how well we're tracking with our most recent estimates of both fiscal 97 revenues, and we actually at this point in time we will probably begin to make an attempt to update fiscal 98 revenues based on what's happening in the market. Well, let me direct your attention to the next handout that's headed ANS prices. This is pretty much the price story in a single chart. You'll note that there are two different kinds of, there are two different lines. One is called nominal and the other is real dollars. Nominal dollars are simply those dollars that come into the Treasury. The real dollars are prices which have been adjusted for the rate of inflation. So that you can see that the, historically, if you look, you'd note that the real dollar trend since 1985 has been declining. And in fact, we believe that over the next 15 years or so, 13 years, that the price, the real price of oil will probably stay about the same, but that oil prices that we receive actually will tend to drift up with inflation. That is basically our long-run assumption that we spent some degree of time on last fall, and we still believe that that's probably a fairly reasonable approach to looking at the very long term. It's really based on assuming that the global demand for fossil fuel in liquid form continues to grow at about 1 to 2% a year. That supplies from outside OPEC will grow at about 1 to 1.5%, which means that OPEC would have to be producing something in the order of 22.5 million barrels a day more than they are now. But if you look at their capacity, they could do that. So we believe that, like as most analysts do, that the outlook for price in the future is probably we may be fortunate to get nominal dollar price increase, but certainly we're forecasting that $16 a barrel inflation adjusted will probably characterize the future. Now getting to that price that's probably got everyone's attention, let's moving in sort of reverse order back to the short run. If you turn to the next page, we have another graph which demonstrates this other sort of what we're calling the price bubble that we've experienced. Oil prices, as you may know, started to run up last year while the session was going on, and in fact, I believe in March, prices of ANS went back up over $20 for the first time in some time. We thought at the time we did the spring forecast that that price would begin to come down, that it was temporary. So did a lot of other folks. Let me just, I know you may have read this several times in the newspaper, but maybe I could run through quickly what we think the phenomenon is all about. Basically, since last spring, demand has outrun supply. And the main statistic that showed up that indicated this was inventory started falling fairly rapidly. It was felt by most of the buyers in the world that that situation was going to be short-lived. There were many projections that non-OPEC oil was going to be coming back very strong, that Iraq was going to be back in the market. Refiners didn't buy, but demand stayed strong. And this sort of demand push continued, and actually oil prices have remained relatively strong through the summer, with core demand, or the demand that's pushed by economic growth, remaining strong, with the result that we came into winter with very lean inventories of a lot of key products like heating fuels and crude oil. And all it's taken is some fairly severe winter weather, and here we are, $24 a barrel. We think the bubble will probably burst. We're not alone in thinking that. There's quite a bit of dispute about when. Our fall forecast suggested that prices would, for ANS would come down from where they are right now. Actually, we thought they'd be about 22 now, but it turns out they're closer to 24. But we thought they'd return to about the $18 a barrel level by April. That's probably still not a bad call, although the futures market's a little more optimistic than that. We think that the reason for this is as follows, that seasonal demand is going to go away. The winter isn't going to last forever. It's going to be summer again sometime. And we believe that the higher energy costs that have been absorbed by the global economy over the last 12, 14 months are going to tend to dampen economic growth as we go forward. So that's also going to halt or dampen, if you will, the growth in oil consumption. Finally, we think there'll be a pretty sizable non-OPEC response to higher oil prices. We've seen it happen on our own North Slope. The companies have more oil in their back pocket. They drill more wells. They're able to undertake more capital investment than they would in the absence of the good cash flow that they've been enjoying. If you turn to the next graph, you'll see our estimate of what this bubble is done for our revenue projections. what we have on this graph illustrates for you how our estimates increased between forecasts. If you turn to the next page, you can actually get an idea of roughly what the price levels meant for us. So far, our best estimate is that oil prices enabled us to bring in an additional $55 million before we closed the books on 96 last spring. And right now, we're steaming towards an additional $540 million over what we thought we'd get last spring, or effectively over $2.5 billion in disposable revenue, which would give you essentially roughly we're steaming towards about $100 million surplus over the revenues that were budgeted last year. For fiscal 98, I was telling you we make an updated estimate using futures prices and making an adjustment to get back to an ANS basis. Right now, we're about $210 million above our last spring's estimate for fiscal 98. Actually, that number, if you go back, it's not here, but we'd be now estimating about $2.12 billion in disposable revenue for fiscal 98. I have one last picture here, and that's the futures price. And I wanted to close on this because we are relying somewhat on these projections that I've given you on using what the futures market is assessing for a discount, if you will, for the price of oil over the next 12 to 18 months. I would caution you about the use of the futures market. It's not necessarily a great forecaster. What it is more than anything else, though, it is a good measure of what people think about the direction of the price of oil. And what I would point out to you on this table is if you compare the current, well, this is relatively current, the current WTI price for a February contract is $25.11. If you go out to February 98, you'll see that the price is $20.10. That means that for a year ahead, the market is assuming the prices are going to come down $5 a barrel. This really, I would say, is one thing that we feel really, in terms of a market measure, it does sort of validate, I guess, our notion that there will be some correction. The other way of looking at it would be, is if we were so bold, and if the market had enough liquidity, theoretically, I guess, we could monetize our expected production by selling on all of our anticipated oil on the futures market, and of course that's not a net of commissions or anything, but it is a measure of just exactly what the market says about oil prices over the next 18 months. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions just on the revenue side? Representative Martin?
Just one general comment. You didn't bring it up today, Chuck, but it's been used so often it's beginning to cause me a lot of concern. It was printed in the papers yesterday that you mentioned that we received 85% of our state income, is what it was, from the oil revenues. And how do you calculate that? Is that just a general fund unrestricted, or do you not consider program receipts and all the other monies, that sources of revenues we have?
That's based on the percent of the what is accounted for in the state financial system as general fund revenues.
Just in general fund. It doesn't count,
yes,
all the other sources and program
receipts. It does include certain things that are called program receipts, but it's as accounted for in the financial report as a general fund.
But it sounds awful high, and of all of our income that we get, about $3.3 billion, not counting the permanent fund, we'll leave that out. 1.7 certainly ain't 85%, or even $2.2 billion of 3.4. I often wonder how you come to that number.
It's based on the accounting of the general fund. Essentially, it's how we calculate it.
Okay.
Representative Terrio?
You mentioned that in the past, when prices have gone up, you've seen increased investment, and compared that to the increased announcements for investment here in the state. But it would seem to me that increased investment is based on the expectation that the price is going to stay a little bit higher well into the future so that they can amortize that investment.
That's a representative, Mr. Chairman. That is a very good point. However, When you have a, say for instance, when you have a higher oil price for as long as we have, I mean, that's a lot of additional money in the corporate treasury, and there are a lot of things that you can do in the short term which will increase the production of oil, even if it's as simple as going out and drilling more wells or bumping a short-term bump in your exploration activity. But yes, commitments to very large field development projects are absolutely a function of expectations about price. The longer prices stay up, it does tend to affect those expectations. It's our assumption right now that, however, that, and I think much of the industry shares that, is that oil prices over time will probably be fairly close to our assumption about the real price of $16 a barrel. But that's, like I say, that's not to say that when you have a lot of cash flow, there are a lot of investment opportunities that you would not have had if you did not have those funds.
Representative Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Watson, is a $5 correction a large correction? Is it the kind that can create selling frenzy and we could actually see a free fall, or is it that large of a correction?
That's a fairly large size correction. However, within the, I think much of that is a function of just how high prices are relative to where where the market has sort of been over the last 10 years. But yeah, that's $5 is a significant correction. I mean, on the upside, we didn't expect it to go up five. So,
I guess my point was, is it the kind of correction where there's some nervousness that that there will be the free fall that we saw down well past $15 or $16 or maybe down to the 13s or the 12s or something like that?
I think that's a reasonable scenario, but right now the thing that really is the story is that underlying core solid economic growth in the global economy that's underpinning the growth in oil consumption. So far we haven't seen a great deal of negative effect from the higher energy prices on the global economy. So it's a possibility, but so far, a free fall is probably, hopefully, is not in the works.
Thank you.
Representative Davies?
Thank you.
One of your two questions.
Yeah.
Two at once.
Does that count?
Yes.
Kind of comment, if you're just looking at the revenues graph, there's an almost a $5 correction in October, followed by a significant run-up, so it's pretty volatile, the price, from a day-to-day basis, I think. The question I wanted to ask, though, Mr. Chair, counting, is has to do with the Cambridge Energy forecast, and I wondered, we've contracted with Cambridge Energy to make some forecasts. Could you just characterize kind of their view of the global market as you understand it, and what they would be saying about Alaska's prospects?
I haven't really seen their outlook. I've spoken with people on Mike Greeney's staff, and it's my understanding that they are focused primarily on demand growth as the reason for the higher oil price. It's my understanding they also believe that oil prices will correct over the next 18 months downward. I believe if what I heard was right, that we're probably about somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 cents a barrel lower than they are for both fiscal 97 and 98, but you'd have to ask Mike Greeney about that.
We can share that later if you'd like. But I think that's right. Revenue's slightly under the Cambridge Energy forecast, but I don't know if it's significant. In this realm, 50 cents a dollar estimate differences are not unusual.
Well, I would think the prudent thing is to stay on a conservative estimate.
Commissioner, would you like to continue?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking longer term, and here the focus is on production volumes. In the longer term, as Dr. Logsdon said, we believe we've done our we believe in the $16.50 real 1997 dollars price. With respect to volumes, the question has arisen whether or not the recently announced investments, which ARCO and BP have said they are going to make in North Slope projects, whether we've included the volumes that they are trying to get. in making those investments in our own volume forecast and hence our revenue forecast. And our November revenue forecast, for the most part, did not include those volumes. And what do those volumes mean? If ARCO and BP are successful and achieve the objectives that they've set out to achieve in making plans to make these investments, then we'll see some increased production volumes by fiscal year 1999 in Alaska's North Slope production. And those increased production volumes over what we forecast in November would be roughly 25,000 barrels a day in FY99 and increasing up to 300,000 barrels a day over our projected case by 2005. That has the effect of pretty much leveling the production profile of North Slope production over that time period. As a consequence of that, pretty much would level if, again, I want to stress, if ARCO and BP achieve the objectives they've set out to in making those investments, it would leave state revenues at about the $1.9 billion per year level for the 7 years, FY99 through 2005. So that's what the effect, and that's assuming that with the fiscal regime that's currently in place with respect to state government. And so in terms of thinking longer term about where you're going in your budget planning and financial planning for the state, it's probably too soon to count on that in your planning, but certainly by perhaps the spring and certainly a year from now, we'll have a pretty good idea about whether that's what we could responsibly count on. And again, for reasons which are certainly not pertinent to an overview, the increased revenue effects actually start a year later than the increased volume effects in terms of the way this would work. I think that's really all I need to say in an overview sense with respect to what's going to happen, we hope, to production volumes. The remaining pages in the handout cover points that the Senate Finance Committee was anxious for us to touch on in an overview. They are not, I think, pertinent to the kind of general overview which you have on the table today. If after looking through that material, it raises any questions, I'm happy to come back and answer them, but I don't think we need to cover those pages today in an overview session.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Actually, I have a couple that sort of on topic, maybe off a little bit. One is the maybe you could just briefly discuss the motor vehicle tax, the gasohol issue, which I know you did discuss earlier.
Yes. It's on the third to the last page, and what you're looking at there is this particular graphic, and the light gray shaded bars are the millions of gallons of gasoline sold per year by fiscal year from 93 through 96. And the dark gray shaded bars shows you what proportion of those bars are taxable. The difference between them is gasoline, which has ethanol added to it so that it is gasohol. And you can see that on an ever-increasing basis, we have gallons of gasoline which are not being taxed at the full rate as a consequence of the gasohol exemption that the legislature put in place. I'm going to guess 1986, but I'm not sure on that.
And just so people know, it's kind of ironic how it came into place, and I guess people should understand. Congress passed one, a federal tax exemption for this during, I think, the 70s when we had the
the oil crisis, largely to encourage alternative fuels, and we did the same thing, my understanding is, based on trying to possibly get some grain stuff that we were doing in the interior and maybe make gasohol as well. So we passed an exemption as an alternative fuel if you put 10% gas together. It rarely had been used. No one ever sold it as a result of the mandatory air standards in Anchorage, in Fairbanks anyway. We started off with what, NTBE, or which health effect problems and everything else, but in Anchorage eventually went to the gasohol as a way to get our emissions down. Unintended consequence, I guess, or it wasn't expected. There's an automatic tax exemption of the 8 cents, is 8 cents a gallon, I think,
yes,
of state tax and some federal tax. I don't know what the proportion is. So despite the fact that it cost them some money, there was a huge less cost, actually, because they paid less in taxes. And my understanding is now a number of companies are just selling it year-round. They don't. In Anchorage, we used to see a switch in the fall when we had to go to our air standards, and be a big jump in the price because of the increased cost of mixing this stuff. But I understand it's either easier, more profitable, for whatever reason, they don't pay the taxes. And what is the estimated revenue loss, I guess you would say, or credit that we're giving? Is it $8 million?
It would be $8 million.
We're not talking about it's a fairly large amount now, and there's almost an incentive to sell this gas year-round and maybe everywhere, regardless of air emissions, because of the economics of the tax break. So it's something we want to keep in mind. Representative Terrio?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got staff working on this, and in fact met with some of the commissioner staff yesterday, and then in a conversation with Representative Hanley last night, I wasn't sure if I perhaps misunderstood your staff yesterday. This tax exemption, or the sales of the gasohol tax, is it primarily in the Anchorage market, or is it now being spread statewide? And I'm just thinking, when I pull up to the pump in Fairbanks, there certainly is no indication that I'm buying a blended fuel, but I'm not sure. Maybe you or Bob?
I'm Bob Bartholomew. I think it's still our understanding that it's primarily the Anchorage area and surrounding that has not expanded outside of basically the municipality of Anchorage.
Mr. Chairman, would you have a way of tracking that? Would you have the information on that, or we would have to get that from the individual suppliers?
I think we'd have to get it from the individual suppliers. We're making our assumptions by looking at the volumes of gallons that are still paying tax. And so it's consistent with the amount of population in Anchorage, that the drop in the amount of taxes is equivalent to that. And if they expanded to Fairbanks or to Western Alaska or Southeast, I think we would see a larger drop than we've already seen.
Representative Martin?
On the same point, I guess, Bob, you'd be the main person. Is this a double windfall to the oil producers? First, they're saving on taxes, then they're also charging the consumer more for the same gallon, so are they making a nice windfall on both ends?
Bob, you might want to actually come up so we can get it on. I don't think the microphone can pick you up back there.
I think it's 25 cents a gallon more in Anchorage, isn't it, when they do that?
To the Chair, Representative Martin, I think it's not I think a double windfall. Two things have happened. Initially, I think there were some capital investments that the industry had to make to be able to administer the additive. And then they do the process by purchasing an additive. So they have a cost, which we have not, you know, been informed of, but they incur a cost to buy the additive. And then they develop their market price. What has assisted them in the market price is by the fuel being exempt from tax at the federal and the state level. It's about 8 cents in state tax, almost 5 cents in federal, so there's about a 13 cent tax break. Again, I think the history of the price is it's gone up a little, it's gone back down. So there hasn't been a huge run-up in price where they're able to recover both a tax break as well as some other benefit. I think the unknown from the department's perspective, when we're trying to look at it and what would be the impact of putting the tax back in place, we don't know what would happen to the market price.
Mm-hmm.
Would, you know, what would the dynamics be? So at this point, I don't think there's been a...
Thank you.
I don't want to spend... I just wanted to bring it up. It's an issue that's out there. It's $8 million. A lot of discussion's gone on informally, so just keep that in the back of your mind. We can have more hearings on that. Commissioner, while you're here, and maybe we can ask Anna Lee, Governor last night, and I don't know who you want to answer or whether you have the answers now, mentioned a bunch of tax credits that are being proposed, both for businesses, welfare, people that, you know, employing people on welfare, a fisheries credit. Have those been worked out enough to know how much we're talking about in credits, what kind of taxes, the dollar amounts we're talking about, or are they still in initial stages?
We're still doing the staff work on that, Mr. Chairman.
So you don't have any...
We do not have those figures. No, we do not.
Okay. Representative Davies?
Just one other quick question. I think on the first additional graph that you provide us, when this is additional revenue to new production.
Yes.
Is this strictly production, or what was the price assumption in this?
The price assumption there is our $16 real.
But that has also been updated since the spring forecast.
That's correct, but when you're looking in those out years, we assume that the price level is going to go back down and
right.
stay on average year on year at the $16 real level.
But I think, just so you know, when the spring forecast, for instance, had the FY, at least the $98 amount in it, to a lesser extent, at $16.75, I think, and now we've got a 1771, I think, for FY98, so almost just for the 1 year. And it's increased slightly in out years, but not to that extent. But there's some price adjustments all the way out each time they do some of these as well. Any other questions? If not, thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Feel free to scoot out if you want. Annalise said you could.
I won't take it personally.
Okay.
I'm hoping my voice will last throughout the meeting. I had complete laryngitis on last Saturday night. Dan Spencer, I think, is the happiest person of all, but I got my voice back so that he didn't have to do this. But there is in the executive budget summary, which we distributed today to each of your offices this morning, and there's some Xerox copies here in case you hadn't brought them with you. Same content, just we had only printed a limited number in the full version, bound version. On page 11, there's a chart which we hoped might help you track for the 97 and 98 budgets. Just in a real quick synopsis form, each of the three time periods, what we thought last spring for 97 and 98, what we then saw with the fall forecast, and now with the January updates, which gives you a quick place to scan for differences in price assumptions and therefore what the difference in the gap would be. I do want to say that I'm looking forward to working with the committee, and in particular on a couple of issues that I think have been of not only considerable interest to you, but also to the administration, some of which I think are already beginning to get underway, such as the deferred maintenance that Speaker Phillips has already discussed with the governor and try to tackle that issue area. Another one is certainly education funding. I wanted to mention a couple of things about the education program. There had been some follow-up questions to the governor's speech last night and thought this would be an opportunity to address those. I think, can probably all agree that it is not going to be possible over the long-term future to have the same level of funding for schools in just nominal dollars that we have today. We've certainly accommodated and the legislature has appropriated the full enrollment increases in the last budgets, and we've proposed to do that this year in our budget. We've incorporated the $12.4 million of increase in school enrollment within our budget. But as we all know, the actual formula unit value hasn't changed in some time, And certainly we can't expect that to continue forever. But I think there's also been a very considerable public concern, as well as concern at the legislative and administration levels, about how that money gets distributed and trying to really make a connection between the funds that we provide as a state to our school districts and some demonstration that that's going to result in quality education. Obviously, a lot of people have been concerned about the fact that many of our graduating kids don't have the basic skills they need for a job and so on. So the proposal that the Board of Education has developed for a rewrite of the formula program does incorporate this concept of tying additional funding in the future above and beyond the enrollment increases to some demonstration of forward progress on quality schools, and including standards for teachers, standards for administrators, and standards that the students have to achieve, and measuring those standards. As we were developing our budget, the Board of Education's proposal was still in its development stages and still being discussed around the state, comments on that. And the budget that we presented to you back in December, that the governor announced actually initially in November, does not incorporate provided to school districts only if they met the quality standards or had a plan in place to do so. As we reviewed that proposal and thought about how to deal with that in our budget context, we felt that certainly any issue as major as revamping how we connect the quality of education to the funding is something that's going to require a great deal of discussion with the legislature and also with the public. And rather than presuppose that conversation, we built our budget with enrollment increases and then acknowledged that there was going to be this additional work undertaken throughout the year. We do, however, still maintain our commitment that over the three-year period, the governor would not be moving off of the pledge to have the budget reductions total $100 million over the three-year period. So the idea was not that this would be somehow busting that commitment. It would obviously mean if we funded that in this next year, we'd have a larger job next year, the following year, to do in terms of cuts. But the governor also recognized that any change that major, if it were going to be tied to some long-term plan for funding of education, would probably require some sort of public vote. That we're talking about an item that is close to $700 million of our operating budget. That's a huge chunk. And for us to provide a secure source of funds in the future for education, and one that does acknowledge that there will have to be some growth over time, that as he recommended last night, it would be a good idea to consider some sort of an endowment. And over the past, say, 6 months or so, since last part of last session and through the summer, there have been a number of ideas that have been raised about how that might be done. Some people have suggested that the Constitutional Budget Reserve could be established as the basis for an endowment, or earnings reserve, or some other mechanism. And I think what we're all looking for is there some appropriate mechanism to do that? And as the governor said last night also, if it does involve the permanent fund, he would want there to be a vote of the people, which I assume you all would as well. But I wanted to clarify that issue of whether it was or was not in the proposal we have now, but certainly it is something that we would be addressing as part of the commitment on the budget cutting side. The context for this year's budget, the last two budgets have been less than the prior years, and even before that and before this administration came to office, obviously, there had been a great deal of legwork done by the legislature and by previous administrations in absorbing inflation and other increases. I think that we've all shared the fact that the public often doesn't acknowledge what a tough job it is just to absorb the inflation and hold the line. But clearly, that's a lot of work that even preceded this administration, but makes it tougher each year as you go along to continue to absorb the increases. The per capita spending does continue to drop, and it does so in our proposal as well for FY98. We've used 1979 as kind of a benchmark year because that's the last year before the oil prices really jumped considerably. We were getting some money in from Prudhoe Bay before then, you know, the lease bonus sales and so on. But the big jump was from $880 million to about $2.3 billion all in 1 year, and that happened in 79. So that's why we've used 79 as a reference point. And again, it's not just this administration, but also the work that's been done prior to absorbing inflation that makes that possible. The FY98 budget obviously is one next step in committing ourselves to a fiscal plan, and we are using in our budget two major tools. One is absorbing inflation and some modest continued budget reductions in nominal dollars, and second is the tobacco tax, so looking at both the revenue and the expenditure side. The tobacco tax this first year would produce just under $40 million. That's the estimate if it were at a dollar a pack. The following year, it would be approximately $44 million, and that's because of the payment schedule from the vendors. We don't get a full amount when the tax first goes, the increase first goes into effect, but we would have a full amount the following year. We have taken, though, into account the whole point of this, which is to reduce consumption, and so although the dollar per pack increases the potential revenue out there, if everybody smoked the same amount, we've recognized a reduction in consumption. With respect to the issue of how much is the right amount to cut, clearly we have a difference of opinion between the administration and the Republican majority. We prefer a more moderate level of cuts. The amount that we had proposed in our plan last year was $100 million over 3 years. We believed back in March when we released our plan that that was a reasonable level. Certainly everything that we hear now in terms of both the immediate price situation and the longer term production, as Commissioner Condon has just outlined for you, to us indicates that that is still very reasonable, and if anything, perhaps more so than it was last March, that we don't need to make significant drastic reductions. We have the ability to work on both the revenue and the expenditure sides toward a balanced budget. We are very sensitive to both the impacts on services and the state economy, and we've tried to present information in our budgets, and particularly in the executive budget summary, to deal with some of those impacts and to tell you what kinds of goals and strategies we have for dealing with major issues in the departments. In arriving at our budget number, we did absorb more than $40 million in increases. That includes the education, $12.4 million for enrollment. There was also about $2.6 million necessary in increases to fully fund people transportation and single-site schools, and that's absorbed within the budget. The formula program growth in areas other than education, and that's principally, of course, in health and social services, with the largest chunks being Medicaid, welfare, adult public assistance, and so on. When we were doing our projections in the beginning of the budget process, it looked like the net result there would be about a $15.3 million increase in those non-education formula programs. That area was and has been over the last couple of decades a very fast growing part of our budget. We put a great deal of emphasis on cost control and on programmatic control in those areas. Obviously, all the work of welfare reform last year is an important piece of that. But also, you'll hear in the Department of Health and Social Services overview from Commissioner Perdue some of the cost control measures and program control measures, particularly in areas like Medicaid, that they're undertaking, some of which have already begun to produce some significant results. We have a huge challenge ahead of us next year, but we wanted to bring control to those areas of the budget that were very fast growing. And as I say, you'll hear more about that. There are some areas in terms of employer cost that were also absorbed within the budget we had. Some of that is in the health benefits increases, just the inflationary increases in health insurance premiums. And then for the university, the overall number for personnel cost for contract and non-represented employees there is approximately $2.8 million. And approximately 6.4 in the general government side, and that's all in general fund dollars. There's obviously more in other fund areas. We did not even attempt to tally the sort of general inflation that we absorbed. There have been some very significant ones. The flip side of the good news of prices being high on oil is that prices are also higher for marine ferries, for snowplows, everything else that requires fuel. We did tell the departments that that was going to have to be part of what they absorbed through other reductions, and we did not sort of grant them any a particular allowance for those kinds of inflationary increases. Same is true for supplies, whether it's for our 24-hour institutions or just plain old office supplies. I mean, any of that kind of inflationary increase was simply absorbed. We did identify a couple of areas where we felt it was important to reprioritize the spending that we had in order to increase our investment in dealing with crime, both adult and particularly though on the juvenile side. We have in our budget funded a number of program recommendations from the Youth and Justice Conference. Some of those are expansions of existing programs that have proved to be very successful. Some are new efforts that the commission believed would take some steps, particularly with kids who are at high risk, those who are right on the cusp of moving into more hardened criminal kind of activity. Additional village public safety officers and additional resources for domestic violence were two others in this whole area of how the state deals with crime that we felt needed some additional dollars. The other is in economic development, job creation. Many of these, though, are funded by the industries that would benefit, for instance, test fisheries, and we are again proposing to separate and make clear the distinction between those increases in our budget that affect the fiscal gap and those that don't. If the sea urchin fishery is willing, folks are willing to fully pay the cost of doing a test fishery there, or where certain permitting activity is fully paid by the mining company or the oil company, yes, it increases our budget, but no, it doesn't increase the fiscal gap because it's fully paid for. And the governor did resubmit a bill, of course, last year almost had passage of the SB 265 Test Fisheries Designated Program Receipts Bill, and I look forward to working with you on that one again this year. The revenue picture that the commissioner gave you, let me just draw out a couple of numbers there. As he said, we're expecting that this year, at least as things look now, the surplus for the current fiscal year would be approximately $100 million. That does drop into the Constitutional Budget Reserve automatically, any surplus since we have borrowed from the Constitutional Budget Reserve in the past. And at this point, with the updates of January that he mentioned, we would be probably seeing a revision to the fiscal gap for next year from the $370 million level that it looked like it would be back in November to something more like $270 million. So clearly a significant difference, but all with the caveat that as long as the bottom doesn't fall out, if things remain relatively steady, that's what we would be seeing for a fiscal 98 within our budget. Debt service, we did have a reduction, or will have this next year, a reduction of what we need in general funds for debt service of $12.1 million. Some of that is a result of the fact that we're selling or paying off the bonds and have less owed, and partly because we're anticipating that there will be about $5.9 million in balances in those debt service funds that can be applied toward next year's payments. That's the best projection at this point. These numbers do assume that all of the school bonds that are kind of in the mill will happen. But just as last year, for instance, for Fairbanks, it was unclear right toward the end of the session, toward the middle of the session, would Fairbanks need the debt reimbursement that was projected? Whether Fairbanks used it or not, there's another school next on the list. So even though people may be aware of changing circumstances in their own communities, we know that another community is right there waiting for the next debt reimbursement dollars. On page, I think it's 12 of the executive budget summary, which we reproduced the 97-98 budget plan. It's pretty much the same format we used last year. We are continuing the practice of showing total funds, getting to your question or comments, Representative Martin, so that you can see not just the general fund picture, but at a glance also all the others, including federal funds, which of course is our biggest chunk there, as well as some revenues from the permanent fund. We have not, as I mentioned at the beginning, adjusted this 98 picture for the information that Commissioner Condon just presented. That's partly because of conversations we had last year, not only with the committees, but also with legislative finance, that it seemed to make most sense to pick two times of the year. Let's do it in the fall and let's do it in the spring. And there's certainly information updates in between, but not changes to the plans themselves.
Annalee, I guess Representative Martin had a...
Sure.
Well, I want to make a comment mostly for me, Mr. Chairman, that I really appreciate you giving a total picture like this. And I think it helps legislature as well as the public know what the true costs, not just general funds. And that's why I get into these questions. When we're talking about state operating, do we mean just general funds or all funds coming in? And you present the picture here very, very well. And also, like you adding in, which I think is the first time I know the chairman has talked about it last year, less duplicated expenditures, and that's a plus. I noticed, though, in the departments, and maybe it's too hard to do now, Mr. Mike Rainey told me they're doing it in the Division of Finance, breaking down the duplicated costs. And boy, if we ever get a handle on that, that would be right nice. And then maybe by the end of this year, you can give us the total cost minus per department, per agency, what the duplication is, and then we know what is the true allocation and maybe the appropriation for that department was. But right now, I'm sure when you first got into the ball game, you were wondering where the bases were, much less what the score was. And I appreciate what you're doing here. The only other comment I have, but we'll save that to later, but to duplicate it, if we can break that down eventually to agencies and department, would help us.
That's a good suggestion, Representative Martin. Much of the duplication happens between the front and the back sections, though, where we appropriate in the front section and then we appropriate in the department. So in those cases, the department shows only is only the one piece of it. One thing that's going to make it a lot easier for us to produce this information in the future is the automated budget system that we're developing now. Right now, there's a lot of extra work to produce these kinds of tables. One change that we did make this year that I hoped would be make this book more informative for you is that we broke down by key program areas for departments some of the major categories, you know, like senior services as a whole group, and used total funds there in the comparison so that people could see, because that's not a way we've traditionally presented our budget to the public. So that you could see overall, taking into account both federal and state funds and the various sources, are senior services going up or down, and so on. And so we tried within each department to extract some of those major kinds of programs, again, not burying the public in all the detail of every single one, which they can get from the budget detail if anybody were so inclined as to put themselves to sleep with all 12,772 pages that we had a year ago, for instance, in the detailed budget books. So. A couple of other things I wanted to mention on the budget plan comparison. We are again continuing the practice that we started a year ago of showing in both years an estimate of what the supplementals might be. Now we realize, I mean, it is an estimate, and there's no way we can know for sure till you don't know it's over till it's over. However, to make more accurate comparisons between the two plans, we have felt that it's only appropriate, and your committees and Ledge Finance have agreed that this is a good way to show it. We've used $17 million is what's in the current plan. This is, of course, not money that has already been appropriated. It's merely as a reference point so that we don't forget that there are certain items, some of which the legislature explicitly dealt with by intent language to say, we want you to come back to us in the supplemental arena for funding of certain areas. And the major ones that have been dealt with in the last couple of years that way are disasters, fires, Office of Public Advocacy, Public Defender, and leases. Those are kind of the major five. Judgments and claims are also ones that have been traditionally handled, and At least at this point, we're not aware of any huge things out there. Last year, there were a couple of very big judgments because of some major cases, but it seems, at least from what I've heard so far, that that's, and I'll say a little bit more about 97 in a moment. Capital budget, we will be releasing early in February. However, we have, as we did last year, already set an amount, and that's virtually at the level of general funds that it was last year, $100 million. There would also, in addition to that, be the money from the HFC capital budget, but this is the strictly the general fund amount. And then, as Representative Martin already pointed out, the duplicated expenditures. And some footnotes you might want to just take, if you are delving into the plan, there are some explanatory footnotes there that talk about which things are and are not included in totals. For instance, our 97 numbers do not include the revised programs that have already been approved by LBNA, but we've given you, for information purposes here, how much that was as of, well, it doesn't include your meeting on Mondays, but everything up through.
They were very generous to you on Monday. It's $3.9 million now, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry.
In what?
In excess. We went over what was estimated. Wasn't my fault, then.
He's chairing the meeting.
Was the chairman. You know, on his way out, he had a little sympathy.
I never brought in the room there. With six people there, you can control for seven or eight, yeah.
One of the things that we showed last year that we hoped, and a number of people told us that it did make this, was helpful in this respect, was to show general funds with and without what we propose as designated program receipts. What that does is give a clearer picture as to which, or in quantity, how much of the additional expenditures, those that are fully, let's say, paid for by industry, do they affect the fiscal gap or not. And so you can see here that although there's a difference in the total of the general funds between the two, the fiscal gap doesn't change. So that it just reinforces if test fisheries are fully paid for by the users, we're not needing to use any of our oil dollars on that, and so it doesn't affect the fiscal gap. This does reflect the bill as proposed by the governor and the one that he reintroduced this week.
Representative Terrio, did you have a question on RPLs?
Well, you actually, Annalee, you mentioned RPLs, but I passed out to the committee members and realized after I had that passed out, I broke a committee rule that I should have put my name on it to identify where it came from. It's a copy of a memo that we received from Mr. Greeny earlier this year that talked about a little bit of concern over you making the decision to change the RP review process. Mm-hmm. And I do have a little bit of concern about that, that you've obviously, for efficiency, decided to give the departments, the commissioners or their designee, the right to shift money around within the department. It used to be, though, because you were really, you had to were plugged in and had to approve that, those shifts, we got knowledge about them much earlier, and I suspect now that you've removed yourself, it's going to be the timeline for us to find out will be longer, or we might not find out at all unless we actually knew enough to ask the question. And I just wanted to let you know that I think that may cause us to be a little bit more rigid in the budget structure that we pass. I know for the past couple of years in dealing with DEC and DEC's reorganization, I was willing to allocate the money in their budget in a little bit broader appropriations. Now that they've gone through the reorganization, you're probably, whoever gets that budget needs to look at drawing a little bit more distinct lines anyway, but since some of this information about shifting around within the budget or within the departments might be a little bit slower coming to us, it might cause us to draw the lines a little narrower even yet, so that the department heads are actually restricted more and will have to call us in to review shifting around money.
I'd be happy to address that. We actually have not changed in any way what the departments can do overall within the department. We are still limited, and as are they, to the appropriations. So if a department has four or five different appropriation levels within the department, nothing in what we have done changes, nothing gives them the ability to move money between appropriations. So this in no way changes their flexibility vis-a-vis moving money from one appropriation element within a department to another. Process that we used in determining whether it was appropriate for me to delegate some of my statutory authority, and of course delegations are allowed, that I went through a very careful analysis of deciding whether this was a wise move or not. But what I had noticed in my first 2 years at OMB, or first at that point about first year and a half, was that there was a tremendous number of things coming through from departments for really fairly small kinds of adjustments from one area to another, which required OMB approval. And yet, we were not turning very many of these down. There are very, very few situations where we were saying this doesn't look appropriate to us. Again, we were still staying within this what you have appropriated the legislature, so I still can't do that. I can't shift money from one place to another between appropriations. But what that raised in my mind was, if the departments are already doing things that are clearly within the bounds of what is appropriate, it's still within their legal parameters of what they can do within the budget, and if we're simply one more place for the paperwork to stop, does that make a lot of sense, or is that the kind of efficiency that it, I should put my own money where my mouth is? If I'm telling other departments to look at what processes they have that are inefficient, I certainly should do the same. So what I did was have one of our auditors from OMB run an analysis of the last complete fiscal year, which was FY95, and there were about just 2,038, I believe, transactions that had come through to us. We broke them down by type. There are some that clearly I still need to review. Anything that's going to go to LBNA as an RPL, I still retain that. They can't go directly. There are a couple of other areas where we felt there still should be an OMB-level review. Any RSA over $100,000, any change in the grants line, that has been a very sensitive area in terms of grants, and I didn't want to just have that not have an OMB review. But for the other kinds of things, we're talking about small reimbursable services agreements between departments, or shifts between the equipment and the travel lines, those sorts of things seem to me that I wasn't contributing anything really to the process. So first we analyzed how much, is there abuse of this, determined that there wasn't. Is there a lot of unnecessary paperwork, determined that there was. We set the parameters. In sending the memo out to the departments saying that I would delegate to commissioners that authority, I told them, number one, it was revocable, and if I found at any point that a department was abusing that, we would revoke the authority to do it, just as we did with in any area where we feel there's if there's an inappropriate action of another kind. The other thing is we set up a process to generate off of the access system a report, which we're planning to do on a quarterly basis, we could do it monthly, and which we've already talked with Ledge Finance about sharing with them. That report, I mean, all this stuff is tracked, and it's tracked in Access, and rather than have departments create separate manual or separate spreadsheets to track it all, we said, gee, we've got an accounting system, we can design a report that will track all of those transactions. And we're just doing the final tune-ups now to that draft report off of Access, and we'll be providing Ledge Finance with the final. So we'll be generating that on a quarterly basis. Our analysts will review it. And again, if I see any evidence that it's being abused, I'll revoke it. But I'll revoke it on an individual department basis. So there's no sense making every department go through a lot of paperwork if only one department is abusing it. But nothing I saw in the review by our auditor in 95 and indicated that departments were abusing the privilege of even recommending to me. I mean, they weren't trying to bust between appropriation lines and so forth. So.
Representative Mulder.
In the interest of time, I'll keep it real short, Mr. Chairman. I understand and I appreciate the fact that you just were taking your own desk out of the paper trail, but in so doing, you also more or less took our desks out of the paper trail and the information loop. Would you be willing, Annalee, to direct your commissioners to continue keeping us in the information loop? Because some of those decisions were sensitive within the budgetary process, and they were discussed in length. And it would be helpful, especially considering some of us continue on within the budgets, to know what shifts are occurring at more than a quarterly basis.
I'd certainly be happy to talk about what would be the easiest way to do that. Again, we were trying to set up a system that didn't require departments to generate whole new sets of reports and so on. I'd be happy to take a look at that and also to work with Ledge Finance as well, because, of course, that we didn't send it directly to each one of you. It went to Ledge Finance, and we'll continue those conversations with them.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Terrio.
And when you, as far as designating that authority, the just looking at the statute here, 3707080 talks about transfers or changes between objects of expenditure or between allocations, so not across appropriation lines, may be made by the head of an agency upon approval of the office, and the office means OMB. So did you deal with the Department of Law to see whether that designation still met the direction from the state law as far as approval being given?
There has already been for years the authority for departments to to do some of those transactions at a much lower level, and we did change. I'll go back one more time with law, but in terms of delegation, you know, there is authority within statutes to delegate out. Again, I retain the overall responsibility. If there's abuse of it, I have the responsibility to revoke the delegation that I have made. Just as a commissioner does within a department, there are things that a commissioner has authority to do. We delegate all the time. We delegate the authority to sign leave slips and so on. I mean, there are lots of delegations, and they're all basically done on the basis that there's a problem. It's revoked on an individual basis. But I still, as OMB director, have to retain overall responsibility for ensuring that that there isn't movement between appropriations and so on.
Mr. Greeny, do you want to make a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to give you a quick update. I indicated on the memo that Representative Terrio refers to that we would be working on this issue. Shortly after I wrote the memo, we got together with the people who operate the access budget system in the Division of Finance Department Administration. And we created a report, which I've come to, in my own mind, refer to as my GILNET report, because the first thing we caught in the net was an agency who was transferring money between appropriations, exactly what they should not be doing. We worked with this particular agency, and they came back with a fairly reasonable explanation that it was an error, it shouldn't have happened. But I still question in my own mind if somebody, whether it was us, OMB or somebody else, just providing that extra check, whether or not it would have happened, and just how long would it have gone on unchecked without this oversight process. I don't know. This particular report we can run on demand. It's coming off the accounting system. It's not a very user-friendly report, but there's enough information that, you know, our analysts can look at it and periodically and see what kinds of these delegated transfers are occurring. I'm not going to tell you how often we run it or whom or what, because publicly, because I think the surprise effect is real important. But we have a report in place, and we're